Thank you, Thomas. First, maybe the audience could introduce themselves to us. How many people in the audience have a PhD? How many people have a PhD in computer science? How many people have a PhD not in computer science? How many are PhD students? How many have I missed? Okay, I don't know what the background of the others is, but it gives some idea of who we're talking to and what may be of concern to these individuals. I noticed when the panel began, it had the title, "Is the Future Still Bright for PhDs?" And I noticed that now it's gone to, "Is there a future for PhDs?" Since I've been both in industry and most recently in academia, let me share the perspective that I had when I was in industry and now the perspective I have being in academia. In when I was at Bell Labs and Bellcore, we tried to hire people who sparkled, and it really didn't matter whether the person had a PhD or what the PhD was in, as long as the person had a breadth of interest and also had done several things during his or her career that suggested that this would be a productive individual for our research environment. So this raises a very interesting question of, do you really need a PhD to do research in industry? Ken Thompson, one of the co-inventors of the Linux operating system, does not have a PhD. And for people getting a PhD, you'll be competing with an increasing number of master's students, particularly in the systems area, who will be very attractive to industry, and also to bachelor's students. So then the real question to ask is, what value will you add that a master's student or a bachelor's person does not? And what constitutes the difference between PhD level research in systems and bachelor's or master's level work in systems? We, as a community, really haven't made that sharp a distinction. From the other side of the fence, being in academia, I worry a lot about the health of computer science in academia for the long term, that if we don't get the best and the brightest to be PhD students, then in the long term it's going to have a significant impact on the field. One of the reasons why computer science is so vibrant, why you see articles about computing in the newspapers almost every day, is that it's attracted some of the most talented individuals on this planet to take an interest in this field. And we need to keep this pipeline alive just so it remains a stimulating discipline for academia, and also I think that for the future of the nation and in fact for the world, we can continue to reap the benefits of computer science and information technology. So this is a very serious concern that if we don't get an adequate supply of the very best people entering into the field, then it's going to be damaging to the field in the long term. For the PhD students in the audience, and particularly those who are about to graduate or who perhaps have graduated, there is the immediate concern of, where do I get a job? And as you see in the statistics, in the early 80s, you had three jobs for every PhD being produced. Now you have three PhDs for every job in academia. At Columbia, when we advertised our position last year, we had 300 applicants for one position. And I think this is true at all of the good schools, that if there is an opening, there is an enormous number of applicants for that opening. So you can't assume that you're going to be able to get an advisor's job or the equivalent of an advisor's job. So if you want to pursue a career in academia, then there are lots of places looking for PhDs, but they're probably not in the top 10 schools, and they may not be in the geographically most desirable at least from your perspective, areas of the country. All the people who are living in that part of the country probably think it's very desirable. So you need some to think very carefully about where you want to live if you want to go into academia. And I think that there will be a lot more demand for PhDs in computer science from foreign universities. We're seeing an explosion of interest in computer science on a worldwide basis. So if you want to go to places like Singapore or other parts of the world, there will be opportunities there. From the industrial perspective, well, we have experts in industry here, so I'll let them make their comments about what's the desirability or the prognosis for hiring PhDs in computer science and industry. But maybe I'll let Mark continue from here.
Let me just go on. Well, I think both, I'm just out of phase with that. I mean, my industry phase instead of my academic phase so much. I was a professor for a number of years. This is certainly, you know, a complicated and vexing question. And I'll just say, with regard to the New York Times proposal, that about the idea that somehow we should eliminate the thesis for the PhD teaching students. That doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, that will, of course, increase the number of them, so we have a problem with overproduction of PhD. That doesn't give me the solutions to make it easier to get one. It seems to me that one thing that that PhD should indicate, or used to indicate, or that certainly we used to as an indicator when we look for people to work at Torrance Park, is it's kind of a badge of insanity. Basically, if you have a PhD, it means you're just a little bit off kilter enough to spend all that time reducing your total lifetime opportunity for earnings by wasting a lot of it as a graduate student. You would have some, very idealistic and maybe good for society sort of goal. And we want people like that. I mean that sort of seriously. It means that you are an unusual person, is what it should mean to get a PhD. I don't know quite what it means to me. It's not enough to just get one. It doesn't mean you necessarily need to, but it should be the indication that you're willing to put, for no necessarily economic benefit, a lot of time into doing something that you consider really important. And that's a very important characteristic for success. I think basically a lot of fairly sane people are starting to get PhDs, and that has watered down the process. one of the things that we will now look for is I will also look for I like to hire somebody who has also solder burns on her shirt and has done user interfaces and maybe started a company or two and then gotten a PhD. Or some other sign of significant breadth. So that's that's another sign of greatness now. Another question about PhDs. I mean, I would say the question is, does academia need PhDs, not does industry need PhDs? It seems to me that more and more my concern about academia is that it is training people that are, training people who are too much, have gone through the system, gotten a PhD, and become a professor, and are training more people like themselves, and have very little actual experience with what the world is like. Even the very best person of that sort may not be sufficiently crazy to think the world better, may not have sufficient sort of understanding of what the world is like. So my proposal, my sort of modest proposal, is that no one should be granted tenure in any academic department until they have 6 years of industry experience. That should be a requirement. I think that would improve industry because it would put some some of the good students in there. And it would also improve academia because it would mean that there would be breadth in fact in every faculty member. So that's my, I don't know what that's a solution to, but it would at least put a slowdown in the PhD generation process because everyone has to go out to industry for a while and then come back. So we'd slow it down by like 5 years.
That would certainly make it. It needs to be more on your
school. More on your school.
Yeah. Everybody who's finishing now, that's telling me there's some different.
No, it's not, you know, it's not sick, it's the tenure, not the PhD.
Yeah.
The tenure requirement.
You wouldn't be applying it retroactively, would you?
Not tenure, that is
continuous. Well, not to you, of course. Look, I completely agree that we need to have the very best people helping to train the next generation of very best people and so on. But I don't think the very best people are the people who spend all their time in academia necessarily. And in fact, often the very best people are found in industry. My modest proposal is to tend to mix that, those two worlds up a little bit.
Thanks.
So,
when I read the questions that were sent, it was hard for me to relate to the difficulties that were being expressed. Let me cite some numbers. I had the Computing and Math Sciences Division at Bell Labs, and we started the year with 165 people. We're going to end the year with around 205. So we hired 40 people this year in the division. I'd say about 75% of them have PhDs. So we're doing our bit for PhD in science. Furthermore, I see us having tremendous recruiting needs for many years to come. And I see that because research in playing a fundamental role in the business, more than it has before. And I'll get in a moment to fundamental research versus coupling with the business. I'll get to that in a second. I think part of the reason why we're emphasizing PhDs so much is that we're part of an industry, and you are also part of an industry, that is a very technical industry. Now, not all companies emphasize technology. Others succeed by having very good marketing. And in Lucent, anyway, the sales are often to people who understand what they're buying and have, if you're selling to AT&T, or you're selling to British Telecom, which I heard on the radio about buying CI. These are, and if that's a customer, they have significant knowledge about the systems that we're building. And so you have pretty sophisticated customers you're dealing with, and technology is one way of being able to provide them with what they need. So, I looked at some charts about what the sizes of the various industries are, looking at the computer industry, looking at the software industry, semiconductors, telecom is actually small. But in many of these industries, there is a significant need for continuing insight because the rules keep changing. The rules keep changing because there are so many changes in the in speed, whether it's speed at which you're transmitting information or speed at which you're processing it. And when the rules change, you have to go and revisit all of the old decisions that you've made. So, in a technical field, I certainly see a need for speed. Let me address, expand on my remark about having fundamental research and companies with the business. There have been lots of articles in the papers, and they started around 89, 90, when Physics Today, one of the Physics publications, reported on the number of people from Bell Labs who were going off to academia, and how industrial research was declining. But look at all of these very bright people going on to academia. What did not get reported was that the total number of people in research stayed the same. For the rebalancing that was going on was that we had less physics, because that's how the field had gone. And we were hiring all these computer scientists in order to increase our computer science activity. Over the last few years, the nature of the coupling with the business has changed too. It used to be it would take years before any of the work we did got into the field. When I first went to Bell Labs 25 years ago or more, I was told it takes 13 years for some inside innovation to make it to the field. But it's closer to a couple of years, or sometimes even faster. And it's that because the way we pick problems has changed. It used to be that people would pick problems, I remember reading papers where people would pick problems and solve them, and then it looked like the motivation had been tacked on. And what we're finding is that we're working with our folks to make sure that the problems that they're working on are solved. And the net result is that what the people tell me is that they're looking to have an impact too. We had one person leave Bell Labs and go on to the AT&T, and the reason that he cited was he had plenty of flexibility, plenty of freedom, but he said our work had not had influence. So he wanted to go someplace where his work had influence. This is what motivates him. So having observed over the last few years, I think that you can have both couple and have fundamental research. Let me briefly talk about what we look for when we've gone recruiting. We definitely look for depth, but we also look for perspective and understanding of where my work fits into the overall field. And part of that is, when I look around at the folks at the lab, they're usually doing something different a few years from now. You know, they're usually, a few years after they arrive, they're doing something different. And so you need the ability to keep up with the changing field, and that is where the breadth kind of thing that Mark was talking about comes in. So, in the one thing that I would say to a graduate student would be, when you've done your work and you pick, whenever you pick a problem, whether it's for your thesis or it's going out afterwards, it's very worthwhile to be able to give the elevator speech. An elevator speech is in the time it takes you to go up in an elevator, can you explain why you're working on what you're I think the elevators that go many floors go faster.
I think you're definitely, saying the right thing. I guess what I would say is the question that you explicitly asked, the question about thesis, should we have a thesis or not? I think we should, but I really don't think that's an issue, in the sense that what we need is a mechanism for getting people to do creative-based research. Thesis seems to be one of the best ways to do that. But I'd probably guess that most people's theses are not actually that important. I mean, it's pretty rare to have someone's thesis be a famous result or a famous document that everyone references and goes back to look at. There are examples of that, but most people, the thesis is more an indicator they could do research, independent research, and do creative research, and that's really important. And I think it's even more important in this field, and I think you started to talk about it. I mean, this field, you know, we all know, is changing, and it keeps changing faster, it seems. I mean, I remember when I left Carnegie Mellon, which we thought was a pretty good place, to go as an assistant professor to Yale in around 1973, and I was just really excited to see Yale had glass CRT terminals. I mean, Carnegie, which was at the cutting edge, had, you know, teletypes. They both had mainframes, and there was nothing called email at the time, and there was ARPANET, but we didn't really have access to. Maybe that was even just getting started. You know, the printers, I mean, don't ask. You know, the network wasn't Ethernet, it was a plug board. I mean, it was very different technology. See, you know, that was a letter in the alphabet. You know, I'll tell you what languages we used to teach. Yale liked APL, and it was kind of a weird language if you know about it. But there were a lot of different things going on then, and people who were trained in fundamentals, people who, you know, were willing to change and be creative, I think, could move forward as the field evolved. Maybe it's even evolving faster. But I think one of the things you really need to see with our students as they finish, it's not that the document they're doing or the exact piece of work they're doing is going to set them up for a 20-year career. I think that's pretty rare. But it's really proving they can do that kind of research and move forward as the field moves forward. And I guess the second thing I'd like to say in that regard, maybe a second point, is the kind of research that people do in academia, I think, there's a real tendency of late to get ourselves in trouble by doing, in some sense, less risky research. I think one of the things that's different now about the field, and some of you all may agree or disagree, than say 10 or 20 years ago, is that there's so much commercial success, so much at stake financially, so many good companies out there doing research rapidly, trying to build new products, so much commercial interest, that a lot of things that we do in universities have a danger if they're not really risky and long-term looking to really be subsumed or be competing head-to-head with companies. And I think that's a really tough place to be. I think what that argues for, which frankly goes against a lot of the visions that some of our funding agencies have, is to really look for people doing more wilder things, things that are longer term, things that companies can't do because of risk or the commercial payoff isn't available yet. Rather than working on, you know, the next, well, I won't say, you know, cut into anybody's particular research line. And we all violate this from time to time, but I think if we don't do more risky things, we're going to be in difficulty. And I think that obviously affects the kind of PhDs we want to see.
Well, I have the luxury of doing that, so I can respond to all of these things. I must confess, I didn't think about this panel until I started the drive in this morning. With all due respect to Thomas, I think that the basic axiom of the panel is perhaps wrong. It's not a question of is the future bright for computer science students, but I think the more interesting question to ask is the future bright for computer science faculty? And I think the answer to that is no. And let me tell you why. You see, if you look at the typical PhD computer science student, first of all, the student is male, so I'll just say he.
Average, the student is
0.78 male. So this guy, and this guy is typically foreign. So my first problem with this statement is, why are the natives a part of this process? I mean, are do the natives know something that the foreign students don't know? What really happened to this crew, you know, when in Rome do as the Romans do? But that sort of started me thinking again, because if you look at the typical PhD student, not only is this student from a foreign country, but he is typically from a third world country. So I now have this sort of mental picture of somebody coming up to, let's say me, and I'm sitting in some house on a street in Karachi somewhere, and somebody says, hey, listen, stop thinking about these bombs going off next door to you for a few minutes. You've just finished a bachelor's in computer science or double E. If you really know somebody at the cabinet level, maybe you can get a job for 5,000 rupees a month, which you can't live on. However, if you listen to me for a minute, I'll actually make you an offer. And here's the offer. Why don't you come to the U.S.? I'll give you enough money in U.S. dollars to live reasonably as a student. And after 3 or 4 years, I'll give you a PhD degree as well. What do you have to do? You have to walk down the street to that nice shiny building, which is air-conditioned, and you have to take a test called the Test of English as a Foreign Language. And perhaps you have to take the GRE as well. Well, it happens to be the only air-conditioned building in the city, and it's 105 in the shade. So why would you say no? Right? That's how I got to be in the U.S. The streets of Karachi, we didn't have anything to do. We had these degrees, we couldn't find a job. And here was this wonderful way to spend a summer. You just went to the U.S. Center, it was a nice air-conditioned building. In fact, it was the only building in the city that had power, because you couldn't dare turn it off, right? Because it was a U.S. Center of Information or something else like that. And it took these stupid tests. And then somebody said, you know, not only will we give you a PhD degree, we'll give you a green card as well, so you don't ever have to come back to Pakistan. And plus, we'll give you $60,000, you know, a salary for $60,000, which is about 45 times more than what you learn in Pakistan. So you end up here. So I don't think that these are foreign schools. I think that these are actually economic refugees. So then I started thinking, why is it that faculty in the U.S. try to manipulate these refugees from third world nations? And I couldn't think of an answer until it sort of struck me. I said, you know, at some point somebody had a weak sort of a technical idea. Now this happens to most of us all the time. Except for in this case, this person's thesis advisor happened to look the other way. And this fellow happened to write it up as a PhD thesis and get a PhD degree out of it. That was not really so bad. But what happened next is that this person also found tech and started to write papers about this idea. Now, as we all know, if you know tech, you can actually publish anything that you like. It isn't really the quality of the result. I routinely spend about 1 week on the technical results and about 3 weeks on my tech macros, making it look nice. Trying to fit 10,000 words in 3 double-spaced pages, you know, without this and this, is an art. And not many people have those kinds of macros. Right? If you actually plotted the number of papers that have been sort of published in this field, you find that there was a quantum jump when tech was first sort of invented. A few months ago, I was on a program committee and I got this wonderful paper on pink pages, which seemed to be manually typed on a manual typewriter because the G was all missing and the F was wrong, and somebody had painstakingly actually handwritten the G's and the F's in the paper. And it was a bunch of people from someplace in Bombay, I think. And I immediately said, yes, let's take this paper, because it was so refreshingly different from all the other test papers. So now we have this professor who started writing these papers in tech. But now comes the rub. He couldn't get anybody to read these papers. So here's the answer. In order to get these to get people to read the papers, this fellow found the idea of using students to not only read the papers, but to write derivative papers on the same bad idea. So that's what we're seeing a lot going on in the world. So my constructive suggestion to this problem is this. You can have a PhD student, but only in an area which is different from yours. So you can supervise the student, but not in databases if you happen to be working in databases. You supervise it in a completely different area. You find three other people to be on the dissertation committee, and if the committee, those three other people say no, this student doesn't get a degree. So that's my conceptual suggestion to this problem. The problem is that we continue to write derivative papers, and we continue to produce students who continue to write such papers, and we end up producing a farm of PhD students who essentially know only the one reasonably bad idea that we have.